consciousness. And mentioned many other times in my other talks, you know, that the mind is the most important thing that we have, yet it's the most neglected and the least understood thing also in terms of, let's say, modern science. That modern science has come to understand, matter quite well, and the body and in medicine, and how matter interacts, and how to manipulate cancer cells, and all about cells and molecules, and many wonderful things. But they little know precious little about really the mind, at least in the way that the Buddha understood it and experienced it. So I want to talk about the mind, and especially in terms of its relationship to meditation, or meditation practice. So basically, the mind has kind of three dimensions to it, although there's many more, but three kind of general basic dimensions. And the first is the active mind, the one we know most about. That means our ordinary consciousness. We wake up in the morning and, oh, yes, oh, I have to do things. And, it's the memory of yourself being in this body and your life, and then we're driven by its desires and its desires, aversion, and also dominated by thoughts of I, ego, or thoughts of I, me, and mine. So basically it's the active mind or conscious mind. We're conscious of this world, when we're awake. But basically it's the mind that's caught between pleasure and pain, and constantly being pulled back and forth between states of happiness, states of sadness or confusion, searching for pleasure or comfort, and trying to avoid painful situations, and also dominated about trying to protect itself. And the ego always posturing itself and manipulating things in order to have its way. So this is, this is where most people's minds are really locked into. And actually that's, the Buddha's definition of suffering, basically, or at least one of them, is the mind that's locked into this active mind with this ego identification, identifying with its body and its mental states, and especially locked into the law of cause and effect, and being affected by everything that comes in contact with it. It reacts either with the desire to want it, or aversion to get away from it, or just neutrality in ignorance. And then, of course, then that's our active conscious mind. But there's also the unconscious. And when you sleep, that's when you come into more direct contact with the unconscious mind. But yet, the unconscious mind is like a river, a continuous flowing river of, in a storehouse, you might say, of all of our past impressions, feelings, emotions, the way that we remember things, our memories about things, experiences with the things and the emotions like fear and so many kind of thoughts. It's like it's a subterranean, continuous subterranean river that's running sort of below the conscious mind. And actually our active mind is simply the conscious mind coming up, the contents of the unconscious coming up and becoming, superimposing itself as the conscious world. Like every time you hear something, you remember something, it's that memory coming from the unconscious up into the conscious mind, and you remember that sound as being this person, that person, or whatever, or this smell, or this sight, all the six senses are caught into that. And all the memories and fears of everything that we've experienced in our whole life and even from past lives is basically available with the unconscious mind. It's sort of like a parallel universe. It's even though right now you have this conscious mind that's sitting here and listening to a talk or in the temple and so on with all these things, but yet just underneath the surface waiting to come up at any moment. Or, like when pain arises, you might wonder, when's this going to be over with? I want to go home. these memories and associations are constantly being flipped into the up into the unconscious. And then there's a third dimension of the mind, and that is what we call awareness. That means an awareness is an aspect of consciousness, but it's a more refined and subtle vibration of consciousness. And it's sort of like the space in which we're aware of other things. We're aware of the conscious mind. We're aware in meditation, you can be aware of your thoughts, trying to come up. Or you can be aware of subtle sensations. The awareness is really the intrinsic and original nature of the mind, or the most purest vibration or activity of the mind. And in that awareness, the ego is not functioning very strongly. It's when the thoughts of I, me, and mine, and all the excitement and the reaction to various objects has subsided, then that awareness becomes more evident and more a tangible experience. And that even though there might be pains and things in the body and sounds going on, the mind is not reacting to them. There's just this quiet space of awareness, and largely with the sense of I having been tamed down or having largely disappeared. So, these three aspects of the mind, the active conscious mind, the unconscious storehouse, it's an unconscious stream that's moving underneath, and then as the third dimension, or the awareness that's sort of separate from that, but it can actually observe that. And that's actually what we try to cultivate in meditation practice. Or it's the beginning of mindfulness. It's what, when you cultivate mindfulness, you start to develop and come into contact. It's not that you really develop it. It's always there. It's like the air in this room. You can imagine it. You see the objects right now. You see these various objects, and you might notice like a thought in your mind saying, just any thoughts that might be going through your mind, or and then the space in the room. But you normally don't pay attention to the space in the room normally, because you're focused on an object. So you don't really see the space. I mean, you kind of maybe know it's there, but not, you don't really like see it, because and especially the more you're reacting and focusing with attachment or aversion on the object, then you don't see the space of awareness. That's why we can't see awareness, because we're too actively reacting to the contents of the mind, or going to sleep. Whenever you start to going to sleep, you cut off also awareness. So understanding those three dimensions of the mind, it's helpful to and useful to remember that. It's the beginning of understanding about what the mind is. But more importantly, in the meditation training, we're training ourselves to become more acutely aware of that, so that we'll be able to transform and change parts of the mind that bring us, the parts of the mind that bring us, suffering and confusion. Now, in meditation practice, also we talk about, in the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha talks about the spiritual faculties. And in the talk I gave last week, I think I mentioned on that the simile of the raft, about how the person, when they, they they start to practice the Dhamma, and they awaken these the spiritual faculties, are the faculties of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So these are potentials of the mind or mental factors, but in most people they're not developed. And even science normally accepts or says that neuroscientists, that the average person only uses 1/10 of their brain capacity. And even somebody like Einstein only used 1/10 of their brain, and the rest of it is not really used. But the Buddha, somebody like the Buddha and other awakened saints, they've learned to tap into their mind and use other parts of the mind to develop these higher powers of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. But the average person is unmindful, is unconcentrated, and dominated by ignorance. Ignorance means not knowing the truth, especially not knowing the truth about the mind, not knowing the truth about the nature of suffering and the nature of happiness, not knowing the truth about the ego and consciousness. So that's why, as you all well know, the whole of the Buddhist teaching is about purifying lobha, dvesha, moha, which means greed, hatred, and delusion. And because we're unmindful and unconcentrated, or especially unmindful, that we get caught in greed and in hatred and delusion, and then involved in the web of karmic actions and their results that we find it hard to get out of. So meditation practice really, especially within the Buddhist tradition, its main focus is on cultivating mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These are the three of the spiritual faculties. The first two are faith and energy. As I mentioned in that simile of the raft, the faith is like, the person that is searching for a way to cross the river, and then he sees the 8 logs in the mud. And so faith springs in his mind that, if I can pull them out and make a raft, I can go to the other side. And then the effort is actually to pull the logs out and to tie them together and take it down to the river and actually start pedaling. But then to cross the river, you need mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom in order to avoid the sharks and the whirlpools and the sandbars and the other things that are all contents of our unconscious, of the unconscious mind. So in our meditation practice, the first step of meditation is to cultivate mindfulness. That means mindfulness, basically it means remembering. It means to remember, but especially to remember the present moment, not how much money you have in the bank. Of course, that could be helpful if you overdraw your checks, but basically it has a very specific function in the Buddhist teaching about the present moment. That means being alert to what's occurring in your body and mind at any one moment, but being alert in kind of a special way, being aware in a special way. And so the developing mindfulness also is a way to rest our attention or to become more centered in the present moment. Now, most of the time, our active mind, it's running between past and future. You hear something, and then you remember that sound based on the future, and then either developing desire to have the sound or aversion to get away from the sound, or something that you see or you smell or taste or even feel in the body. That the mind is always identifying things and bringing its memory of the past and then projecting that into the future with more desire or aversion or just simply a delusion. So the mind is not really grounded in the present moment. And all problems are problems of the past and future. Try to think of any problem that you have and see if it's not related somehow to the past or future, even if it's just like 2 seconds ago. Like, let's say, okay, we're going to meditate for an hour now and sit still and don't move. Immediately the mind jumps in the future. Oh my God, I can't sit for an hour. And it's thinking about, the pain that it's going to have in the future, in the next 2 minutes or so on. So we can't really enjoy the present moment because of the fears, either the fears or the desires of our mind that are interfering. And because those fears and desires then either bring in more greed or lust or desire, or they bring in fear, anxiety, worry, hatred, whatever, the whole gamut of mental states. So therefore, the mindfulness is the ability to try to hold the attention more in the present moment. And it starts with the body and breathing. Now, in this Wednesday's sutta studies, I'm going to be starting to talk about the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Buddha's main discourse in cultivating, of course, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So I'll be covering that in more systematic way. But but basically, in the practice of meditation, we use the body and breathing as an object of the present moment because it's the natural thing. And it's always occurring. And also the mind's true home is this body. You know, when you were conceived in the mother's womb and just a one little cell, invisible one cell thing, at that time even you had consciousness. According to the Buddha's idea about the rebirth, that consciousness enters the body at the time of conception. And And it's the mind that actually, you know, drives the development of the body. And so, you know, that consciousness was there even in the, you know, the one-celled organism, then it's divided, and every time it divided, that consciousness became in the other cells as well. For 9 months, basically, you lived with just body awareness. You were inside the mother's womb in a nice, warm, cozy place, and all you had was basically the developing body. And the heart started beating and so on, and around whatever months. And so, you know, that's what I'm saying. The body is the real true home for the mind. That's where it started from. And only when you came out into this big bad world with its millions of objects, then the mind started going outwards. But its true home for 9 months was just sitting there cozy in the present moment, feeling the body, the breathing, maybe not the breathing, but whatever, the heart beating and so on. So, you know, the breathing body, that's what I'm saying. It's a natural home for the mind, and that's why the Buddha chose it for the starting point for the meditation. Because there's lots of meditations out there that have you try to visualize fantastic scenes, you know. They try to have you visualize you floating, you know, on the clouds or walking through a beautiful forest or, you know, all kinds of visualizations. Or other ones have you chanting mantras and doing lots of other things. But even those things might have some temporary, you know, kind of good effects. But for the practice of mindfulness and the development of wisdom, the Buddha avoided those extra type of things because you already have too much mental activity. And so by focusing the attention on the body and breathing, it acts as an anchor for the consciousness. So therefore, anyway, you develop this mindfulness and attention to the body, and then to the breathing. The breathing is naturally occurring in the body all the time. And so by feeling the body, you'll naturally feel the breathing too. And so that's the sort of the first stage of mindfulness, is learning how to gradually stabilize the attention in the present moment and then become concentrated. Now, concentration is basically unbroken mindfulness. That means it's mindfulness focused in a limited area. So we use the posture or the breathing equally, or both together even, as I normally try to recommend people, as your object of concentration. So concentration is ability to hold your attention in a limited area, either on a single object or on just a limited focus. Whereas normally our mind is unconcentrated. You know, we get easily distracted. We start doing something and then you get distracted so easily. Like even reading a book or something, you get distracted by so many things and the mind's not used to keeping its attention in one spot. And so it becomes scattered. So the holding the attention on the posture, the breathing, is the function of the concentration, is developing concentration. But the mindfulness is also working at the same time. And the mindfulness actually needs to be cultivated first. Because if you're unmindful, you'll never develop concentration. Because it's the mindfulness that's alert. You know, as I mentioned, the main obstacles to meditation are physical pain, sleepiness and so many various types of thoughts, you know, desire, aversion, confusion, and the just wandering thoughts. And so because we're unmindful, those things drag our attention away and then we get disturbed by them. Because we're not mindful of them arising. So mindfulness also is like a monitor, let's say a computer monitor. You're in a computer, you know, and it's whatever they call it, the CPU or so whatever, you know. It can monitor the everything else that's going on in a computer. You know, it knows when you're trying to print or, you know, it knows when you want to use some other gadget and so on. And it's sort of monitoring things. So awareness is like that. It's like a light, the light of awareness that's in the nervous system and can notice anything that's happening. So so both those mindfulness and concentration have to be balanced. And they can work simultaneously. And so, like in the Satipatthana Sutta, the first thing that the Buddha mentions is about first feeling your posture, you know, feeling the sitting posture and being mindful of that, and then tuning into the breathing. And so, you know, the part of your attention is focusing on the breathing, but you have like a reserve of awareness that's alert to notice, a pain is arising. Oh, you're getting sleepy now. Take some deep breaths. Or you're starting to think now. Let go of that. Come back. So the mindfulness helps us to detect the potential distraction, to let go of it or relax around it, and to be able to keep coming back to refocus and keep the attention on the primary object. So the primary object of the meditation is sort of your concentration, the faculty of concentration. But at the same time, the mindfulness has to be present in order to keep that concentration focused. So they're working simultaneously. And the quicker and clearer your mindfulness is, the quicker you'll be able to let go of distractions, and the more the concentration will become uninterrupted. So, you know, in the beginning of your meditation, you are lucky to, you know, maybe see one or two breaths before either you start to drowse out or get lost in a thought or get distracted by some itch. And you have to bring the mind back. And you might notice one or two more breaths, and then again the mind will get distracted. But little by little, then you'll start to notice three or four breaths in a row before it gets distracted. Then sometime later, you might notice, you know, five or six breaths in a row before the mind gets distracted. Like that technique of counting the breaths. That's why that's a good technique, because you can gauge how much progress you're making in concentration before the mind loses its count. So you might have gotten up to three before and then kept on getting lost. But then later on, I made it to five this time. Oh, I made it to seven this time. I made it to 10 this time. Even made it all the way to 10 and back to one. So you can see that then the concentration is improving. And you'll be able to see it and understand why, because your mindfulness is alert enough to notice the potential distractions. You notice subtler thoughts trying to arise, so you can let go of them before they would have taken you out into the past or future. Because thoughts are like water bubbles arising from the bottom of a lake or a river. You know, you don't normally see the bubbles until they are up on the top. You know, they come up and then they're sitting on top of the water and then they burst. So our thoughts are like that. They're coming up through the unconscious. Normally we don't see them because we're distracted. And then they get to our mind. And then before we know it, we're lost in the thought. Oh my God, we're thinking. And, you know, then it's harder to let go of them. But the combination of the concentration and the wisdom, the concentration helps you to see the subtler thoughts. And seeing the subtler thoughts helps you then to get more concentrated because you can let go of them quicker, not spending so much time lost in thoughts. So you see, it's a reciprocal back and forth relationship between the concentration and the mindfulness. The mindfulness helps you to develop your concentration, and while you're getting more concentrated, the nervous system becomes more calm and you can notice subtler distractions. And that improves your concentration. And the concentration improves, and mindfulness gets more clear. You can even notice subtler and subtler distractions before they take you away. And that improves the concentration. So it keeps on going like that. And that's how you have to balance in the practice of meditation. You balance both the mindfulness and concentration. And there's infinite degrees and levels of mindfulness and concentration. But I wanted to bring in now the third factor, the last of the spiritual faculties of wisdom. We talk about mindfulness and concentration. Now, these are the two most important in the beginning. But then wisdom in the long run is you know, equally, if not even more important. But you cannot develop wisdom without the mindfulness and concentration. And what is wisdom? Well, wisdom is the ability to understand what you're observing. It's like the meditation, as I mentioned in many talks before, is like the scientific experiment. And this body and mind is like our laboratory. And the body is the lab, the bio lab, the chemistry lab. And the mind is the microscope. So in the lab, you have to have a steady laboratory table that's not moving around. You know, it's bolted to the floor, not moving. The microscope is bolted to the table. And so it can't be jiggled or moved. And then you look through that. So the same way we hold our posture still and we focus the concentration is like looking down through the microscope. And the mindfulness is, you know, able to observe the movements within that object. So, for example, say you have a blood cell, you're looking through the microscope, and the scientist is looking through that, and so to keep the mind focused on the blood cell, it's like the concentration, but the mindfulness can notice movements within that blood cell. Might notice the other things within there moving around. And then the wisdom understands the meaning of it. Because if the scientist doesn't have any basic wisdom and doesn't have the ability to put two and two together, what he's observing is not going to probably lead to the cure for whatever disease or how to make some, you know, synthetic drugs or whatever it is. So the wisdom is understanding what you're observing. So the object is this body and mind in the beginning, or the body and the breathing, to develop mindfulness and concentration. And then the first level of wisdom, what we observe actually is anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So when we talk about wisdom, from the Buddhist perspective, you know, within the Buddhist teaching, the wisdom is the wisdom of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering, dukkha, and anatta or no self. You know, the tilakana, the three characteristics of all phenomenon, that all things are impermanent. And if you cling to things that are impermanent with attachment, when they change, you'll suffer. And there's no one who is really controlling any of the activities of the body and mind, because it's being powered by the force of the past karma and of the, you know, the present sort of thoughts and reactions. And so it's this wisdom that actually becomes the important thing in along with the mindfulness. That the hallmark of the higher development of mindfulness is it has this wisdom with it. And if mindfulness doesn't have wisdom with it, then it's a very low level of mindfulness. And it's not right mindfulness according to the Buddhist teaching. So, you know, in the Buddha's, in the Eightfold Path, all those steps of the Eightfold Path are, start with samma, you know, samma ditti, right understanding, right thought, and, you know, right mindfulness. That means it's mindfulness. It's not just attention, but it's a specific type of attention that has, it's tuned in to impermanence, suffering, and eventually no self. But impermanence is the first level of wisdom because it's the easiest one to notice. We can see how everything changes. And I actually forgot to mention that the objects of our mindfulness are the five aggregates, the panchaskanda. That means the sense objects, the physical forms, feelings, perceptions, the various types of mental activities, emotions and reactions, and the consciousness itself, the sense of I, the ego consciousness, and the I that's always behind the scenes, trying to control and react to things. So those are the objects of mindfulness, and we see that they're impermanent, that all these five aggregates are impermanent. And so, but we first, you know, direct it at the body. And so we can see how the breath is impermanent. The in-breath arises, lasts a moment or two, and stops. So that's an aspect of impermanence. It's impermanent. It means it's just a momentary sensation, the sensation of breathing in. The in-breath, you know, arises and vanishes, and then the out-breath arises and vanishes. Then you notice some other sensation arising and vanishing, or the heartbeat. One heartbeat will just, you know, arise and vanish real quick like that, or feeling some other itch, or a little gurgling in your stomach, or a little sting in your eye, or any number of infinite millions and billions of various sensations. And so mindfulness is the ability to tune into that. And I'll be talking more about this when we go over the sutta on Wednesday for those who come to that. But so, but it's the faculties of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These are the, you know, again, the spiritual powers, or the spiritual faculties. And they're called faculties or spiritual faculties for a reason. You know, like a faculty, what is the faculty in your university? What are they there for? They help to guide the students on their studies, right? Like if you're working on a PhD, you have some faculty supervisors, right? And they, you know, they're guiding you in your research. So in the same way, the faculty is mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. They're the faculties that guide us to the spirit. Now, of course, the spirit is not normally a word used in Buddhist teaching, but generally it means to the, you know, spirit. When we say spiritual life, we mean the life leading to truth, the awareness of something beyond the body and the mind, or some deeper ultimate realities, and so on, whatever it might mean to different people. But in Buddhist context, we mean those faculties that lead to wisdom, the wisdom beyond the mere superficial, you know, work. So so mindfulness, concentration guide the mind, you know, through the various levels of the body-mind experience. Because the mindfulness, when the mind starts to get off of the concentration, the mindfulness puts it back on. Like a train going down the tracks. You get the train's got to stay on the tracks. Look what happened in Spain a couple of weeks ago, right? It was going too fast and the train jumped the tracks and killed a lot of people. That's what happens to our mind. When we get moving too fast, we're not mindful and our mind jumps the tracks. That means it loses its what it should be focusing on and gets involved in some negative or unskillful types of thoughts and crashes into somebody else. You know, get in a fight and suffering or death. So the spiritual faculties of faculty of mindfulness keeps getting the train on the track. And as the train stays on the track more and more, that's the concentration. It gets closer to its object, its destination, which is the wisdom. And then, you know, it starts the balance. I have a little formula. Mindfulness plus concentration equals wisdom. That means when mindfulness and concentration are equally balanced, then the natural wisdom that's within your mind arises. That means the natural wisdom. That means the clarity of consciousness, the natural inner light and awareness that sees even the atomic and subatomic movements of the nervous system and the various activities of that's going on in the body and mind. It can see them very clearly. And what it sees is that they're always changing and nothing is stable. So that's the wisdom of impermanence, is this ability to see that all of our body sensations, thoughts, feelings, the sense organs, sight, sound, smell, taste, they're just arising and vanishing one after another through the nervous system. And of course the ignorant person is grabbing at all these things, and because of that clinging and grabbing, the illusion of this world gets created, and the sense of myself being caught in this world actually is a creation of the mind. But not in the average person knows nothing about that, because they don't have their faculties of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom are non-existent. And so that's the hallmark of a wise person, or, you know, a disciple of the Buddha in practicing meditation. We're, you know, cultivating. It's the wisdom, really, that the wisdom is what leads to the ability to let go and transform the mind ultimately, and to realize, of course, liberation, to realize enlightenment. And so with each degree of developing mindfulness and concentration, as they get balanced and stronger, then the wisdom deepens at each level. There's a direct corresponding relationship to the strength of one's mindfulness and concentration as to the revealing of the wisdom, because the wisdom is already there in the mind, we just can't see it. And so the wisdom of impermanence comes first. And because of impermanence, you see how when you cling to things that are impermanent, suffering arises. And by resisting impermanence is when suffering arises. And we can't accept impermanence. And we're wanting to things to last, but they don't last. And then we suffer on account of that. And that grasping and aversion is what creates the sense of ego also. So the perception of impermanence leads to the understanding about suffering, the nature of suffering and happiness. And at the same time, you begin to understand how the ego is actually being created and recreated moment by moment within the mind. So anatta. Anatta is the deepest level of wisdom. So the first level of wisdom is impermanence. But when you understand impermanence, then you will understand the suffering. And then the deepest level is then to understand the illusion of the self, or to understand the anatta. So anyway, I'm going to be talking more about these things and other, talks and so on, as I mentioned in the Wednesday class. We're going to be starting our study of the Satipatthana Sutta. But I just wanted to kind of clarify some of these things about the mind, and especially this, because in the meditation practice, it's these three mental faculties and powers of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom that are the hallmarks of the Buddha's teaching, and given so much emphasis and focus. But in all the various lists, the mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, they're mentioned basically in the Eightfold Path. It means right understanding and right thought are part of wisdom. Then there's right mindfulness, right concentration. And in the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, even, they're also mentioned. But because people normally don't know what they are and don't know how they interact and to support each other, but that's really the skill in meditation, is learning how to cultivate those. But basically it starts with the mindfulness and concentration. That's why if you can't learn to be aware of just sitting and breathing, the reason why I emphasize that is because everything is occurring within this, this breathing body. And so to get centered in the middle of it is sort of like taking a front row seat at the movies, And you're just watching the body sitting and breathing, and then you watch it start thinking, you watch it feeling pain, you can watch it in all of its various types of reactions. But you have to develop this ability to detach the mind and just watch and observe. And using it as one's anchor, becoming anchored in that. So until one can really cultivate that, at least to some degree, then developing deeper levels of meditation will be much more difficult. So I think I might finish this talk on for now. And if any of you, if you're not in a hurry to go soon, if you we can open it up to some questions, if you have any questions based on any of that I just talked about, then feel free to ask any questions. don't feel shy.
Okay, I have a question about that. You're talking about active mind and passive mind.
Who's asking? I can't see. Oh, you don't have to stand up.
So you're talking about the active mind and passive mind and the simple awareness. Is that the same as unprompted consciousness and prompted consciousness? That, you know, the company's special day connected with right view or wrong view, two situations. Can those exist at the same time, or just they occur just one at a time?
Well, yeah, you'll read a lot of different terms, you know, within the Buddhist teachings, and there's many different terms, especially describing consciousness, but they're just different aspects of the consciousness. And there's a, you know, you can observe the mind react to something, sort of like an itch. Let's say you feel an itch, and then that's prompted consciousness drove the arm to reach up and scratch, or it recognized that it's a painful feeling and it thought, I want to get rid of that painful feeling. You know, that's what I call a reactive consciousness. It reacts to the object, whereas the imprompted consciousness, if you want to use that term, would be more like the awareness that I can observe it, and I can observe the urge to want to itch, but I can relax around it, and then that urge will kind of disappear, and it won't turn into the active consciousness that would cause me to want to scratch. So, but that depends on the strength of one's mindfulness and concentration, whether that consciousness is going to turn into a prompted or a reactive consciousness, or it's going to remain in a more passive, detached awareness, and just let the various thing come and go without reacting to it. That's going to depend on your mindfulness and concentration. That's what enables you to have that detachment, is to the degree that you're mindful in your concentration. Concentration, as you stay more concentrated and focused without being distracted, it's like having an injection of a tranquilizer into the nervous system. But it's, of course, not using any sort of drugs. It's natural. And so it's because you're not reacting to things, the nervous system becomes tranquilized. And that allows you to observe without that neurotic edge, so to speak. And that is the function of concentration, is tranquility. That's why it's called tranquility meditation. You know, the shamatha bhavana is called the tranquility meditation, because as you're able to hold your attention on the object longer and longer, but to do that, the mindfulness has to be working simultaneously. But as you do that, then it's like short-circuiting the nervous system. It's like a switch in the nervous system gets switched from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system. These are terms used in anatomy. But it's very interesting to see that relationship. The sympathetic nervous system is a reactive nervous system, and the parasympathetic is the more passive type of nervous system awareness. And so you can actively shift that. Normally people can't, of course, but that's where we're getting control of the mind. And in meditation, developing mindfulness, concentration, wisdom allows you to key in and unlock the door to the nervous system to actually make some changes there, you know, to short-circuit it, to rewire it, you know, to change that wire of hatred to connect it over to create another wire of metta or something, or at least more relaxation. But the way to do that is only through mindfulness and concentration. And then, of course, the wisdom that allows you to do that too. Yes?
Bhante, we normally loosely use the word subconscious mind. When you say unconscious mind, is that synonymous or is it different?
Yeah, I use the words more or less interchangeably. Now, other people might make some distinction. No, it is, but I don't think it's that big of a deal. Basically, it means, but the subconscious mind isn't some fixed entity. Conscious and unconscious, the only difference is the degree of your mindfulness. Because you're mindful and unconcentrated, your conscious mind is very narrowly focused. But as you stop reacting to the conscious things, simultaneously you become more aware of things kind of just under the surface. And so in meditation, you're aware of both. I mean, you can hear sounds and things going on outside, but you can also notice subtler sensations occurring and all over the body, or even subtler thoughts working in the back of the mind. So now you're aware of both simultaneously. Or the lines anyway becoming blurred. You know, there's no kind of concrete division between conscious and unconscious. It's just a matter of degree of one's depth of mindfulness and concentration as to what you're aware of. So basically, meditation is making what was normally unconscious, bringing it up into the conscious field. Like when people see a nimitta, when they're developing concentration, they might see a little pinprick of light or a star or some light in the mind. You know, that's an unconscious, that's normally an unconscious thing. Very subtle, you know, brain wave phenomenon, but you become conscious of it. And people who develop that can see it all the time if they want. It becomes nothing special. It's just that we've allowed our mind to get stuck in just this superficial external world. And only once in a while people might feel something inside, but then they get fear. Like see a nightmare and you get feared and worried. And, you know, because you don't understand what is going on when these unconscious things arise, memories and so on, but they cause people a lot of problems because they don't understand it. But once you understand it, they don't cause you any more problems.
I was just wondering whether there are three levels, because now there is a level at which we function, where we hold our head straight, and there's an unconscious operation where the body does the breathing and holds the head straight. For example, we don't realize that.
Yeah, all those things are happening simultaneously. That's right. The mind can do does many millions of things. Not the mind, but the body. I mean, the body and the mind are really not separate. Every cell of the body has consciousness and has intelligence. You know, even your blood cells. So that's body, but it's also mind. They're not really separated. And, you know, there's millions of things going on in the body at the same time. You know, you could be healing five or six different injuries. It would be healing them on their own inside of you. And, the mind is like more powerful than a supercomputer. You know, processes more information and things in a supercomputer, and faster, if you can imagine that. But 99.9% of it is happening in that unconscious level, because simply our mind is undeveloped and it's stuck in this drowsy state. And because of its clinging and attachment just to a few superficial things, it gets stuck there. I forgot to mention, and the mind really is like a television or radio set. You know, even in this room, there's how many stations, Ottawa radio station frequencies are if you had a radio and turned it on, you could get any number of different stations, right? But they're all here passing through this room. We don't see them. Because our antenna, your dial is fixed on one particular station. You don't see the other ones. But you can easily switch it. Just that fast, you can tune out that one and tune into another one. So the same way with our mind. We can learn to tune out this and tune into something else. Tune out the past and future. Tune into the present moment. Tune into our breathing. Or whatever you want to focus it on. But most people don't have that power. That's because they don't have concentration. Mindfulness and concentration. And we've never been taught that. Even that should be the most important thing we ever taught in life. We're not taught that. What are we taught? How to hate other people. Or how to have greed and craving for things. You see, the world's turned upside down from the Dhamma point of view. And that's why the Dhamma is not for the unwise. The Buddha said, this Dhamma is for the wise, not for the unwise. This Dhamma is very deep and difficult. But it's the only thing really there is. To turn away from it is like spitting at heaven. But anyway, okay, I think maybe that'll be enough for this evening, so...